Welcome to Ancient Future Faith with Dr. Chris Alford, pastor of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community in Sacramento. Just what is ancient future Christian faith? Join Chris each week as he talks with special guests about a refreshing renewal in evangelical worship and spirituality that's helping many believers get in touch with their ancient Christian heritage. Now, with another look at how the road to the evangelical future runs through the ancient past, here's Dr. Chris Alford.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome back to another edition of Ancient Future Faith. My name is Chris Alford. I'm the host of the program and also the pastor of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith church in Sacramento, California. As always, love to have you zip over to the website, epiclesis.org, and learn more about the church. On this program, each week, we love to bring you folks to talk about this thing called ancient future Christian faith. What in the world is it, and how is it impacting, if at all, evangelicalism across the country and world even? And today, I'm very pleased to have not one but two guests in the ancient future faith studio. First of all, the Reverend Nathan Oates is in the studio with me. He is the pastor of Emmaus Church in Lincoln, California, and also proud to have my buddy and partner with me, Dr. Rick Ashey, who is the pastor of intergenerational discipleship at Epiclesis. Hi, Rick. Welcome.
Hey.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you with us. And it was you, Rick, who introduced me first to Pastor Nathan. And folks, you may remember, and I want to have you cast your memory back to a few months ago, when Nathan was a guest on this program just prior to heading off on a sabbatical to Italy. And I said, Nathan, I surely do want to have you back. We can kind of do a before and after you make this wonderful trip, sabbatical trip to Italy. And Nathan, you're back.
Good morning.
It's good to have you.
Thank you.
So this last summer, you took some time with your family. And if you would, tell us just a little bit, in case folks didn't hear that podcast, give us an overview of the trip that you made. And I know there were several components to it. And then let's break down, as promised, some of the things you learned and experienced there.
So we're grateful to receive a 10-week break from our work and responsibilities at the church. And we spent the first 3 weeks together as a family in Italy, just kind of seeing the big cities, Florence, Rome, some of the classic stuff that I guess the expected things you would do in Italy. It was beautiful and ate way too much gelato, if that's possible. I'm not sure that's possible.
I don't either. You did the tourist stuff then, right?
Yeah, we did a lot of that. And we kind of quieted down and spent some time in the countryside as well. So that was 3 weeks together. And then for work and sports reasons, the rest of the family came home and I remained in Italy for a month by myself.
Wow.
And most of that time was at a monastery in the north called, in this town called Norcia.
Right, which is sort of the hometown of somebody very famous.
Right, it's the birthplace of Saint Benedict, who's considered the father of Western monasticism. He was born there in 480 AD, and when he was 19, traveled to Rome to study and became really disillusioned with both the culture and the church, and went to live in a cave by himself by the river for 3 years, and in the process begins to build these Christian communities called monasteries.
Nathan, I remember part of the story about how you got hooked up with this particular monastery. I know there was a local nun, I think.
Right.
Tell us again about how you made that connection with this particular monastery.
Okay, I was just listening to a radio program like yours, and the guest was a Dominican nun, and she happened to be based out of Loomis, which is the next town over from where I live, and connected to the radio station because I was really captivated by her story. And we ended up meeting, and this is about 10 years ago. So over the last decade, we've had a correspondence. She's been in Rome, currently in Michigan, and I've just developed a friendship. So I've appreciated that on a few levels, and she was able to connect me to the founding prior or abbot of the monastery in Norcia, the Benedictine monastery in Norcia. And they made an exception, which I didn't fully appreciate at the time, which was to allow me to stay there for up to 3 weeks. Normally, guests would be permitted for just a few days, but they hosted me for an extended amount of time, which was unusual on a few levels, including the fact that I'm not a Roman Catholic.
Right. Well, one of the things I want to touch on in a minute is the good and the bad and the ugly.
Good.
And it occurs to me that being in a place of solitude like that for such a long time, I mean, it sounds long, 4 weeks, I think you said, that's going to have some wonderful upside and also some challenging things as well. Today's very special guest is Nathan Oates. He's the pastor of Emmaus Church. Also in the studio is Dr. Rick Ashey, my friend and colleague at Epiclesis. Pastor, before you left, you said that you wanted to accomplish some things, and I'm wondering if you, now on the backside of this trip, do you feel like you accomplished a lot? Is that even the right word? And give us at least a big picture now of what you feel like happened to you while you were there.
I know what you mean, I think, by in the sense that I had some goals and hopes for the experience.
Yeah. I'm trying not to make it too scientific and measurable.
Right. Yeah. And I'm an achiever. And so I typically see things as accomplishments.
Right.
And
right.
That's not always a healthy approach
sure.
for me. But the big motive was that for about a decade, I'd been reading about Benedictine spirituality. But everything I knew about Benedictine spirituality was from books. And that's wonderful, but it's dramatically incomplete. And I needed to see it lived out. And so that was my ultimate hope, was that I could share life with these monks and discover what parts of the rule have become obsolete, which parts of the rule they still adhere to, and how, because the culture has changed so much in the last 1600 years since it was written. And so there was I want to learn about Benedictine spirituality lived out by monks. There was also the personal hope for growth, because I've been so personally challenged by the writings of Benedict that I wanted to really open my heart to what God would do in and through that place. And then on more of a formal level, I hoped to interview some of the monks and then just observe the way they lived in order to kind of fill out a research project that I received a grant for, which is about the vow of stability, which is the first of the three Benedictine vows, that vow might be implemented, embraced in non-monastic modern communities such as our church in Placer County.
Well, okay, yes. And that reminds me, that's one of the key things I wanted to talk with you about in this program. So you've given us a nice little outline there, I think, of how we ought to approach this.
Great.
So let's dig in. You went to this monastery. They're living by a rule that is very ancient.
Right.
What did you discover about its elasticity, if at all?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things that I had no idea about when I arrived there, as I mentioned, the reason I went to that monastery was simply because of a relationship and a connection with the leader there.
Right.
What I did not know was there's all sorts of conversations within that community that are ongoing. And one of them has to do with the wisdom of the Second Vatican Council.
Which I think you better touch on just.
Sure. So in the Roman Catholic Church, there's obviously in history of the church, there's a series of big church councils and points of decision, and the most recent was 1961, the Second Vatican Council, and it's often known for some of the major shifts that happened in Roman Catholic practice at that time. For instance, priests celebrate communion now facing the community, not facing the altar.
Idiomatic language, I think, is another.
That's another big one, yeah. Until 61, you're only celebrating Mass in Latin, not the vernacular of the culture, I think is how it's put. And so I was vaguely aware of the Second Vatican Council because I studied at a Catholic college for a while. But the discovery at the monastery was that a major conversation happening within their context was about the importance and the relative sacred nature of the Latin rite.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. So this monastery is fiercely committed to this early Latin rite. So they are very on the kind of common spectrum. They're incredibly conservative and they adhere to the rule at a level that is arguably unprecedented around the world.
Wow.
They asked me, why did you come here? And what was behind that was the recognition that you've kind of jumped in with the green berets of Benedictine monks. Like there is no variance allowed here. There are very few accommodations made like have been made in monasteries around the world,
right,
because culture has just moved forward. For instance, Chris, they sleep in a dorm situation because the rule says that's the way you should
sleep. Right, which is, as I understand it, unusual among monasteries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most are now providing individual rooms or cells for them, for the community members. So there was this extreme element that I encountered there in terms of their devotion and their commitment to a specific way of doing things that was even beyond what I anticipated.
You said there was a debate there amongst mm-hmm. them about Vatican II mm-hmm. and the, for lack of a better word, strict adherence to right. the rule. Mm-hmm. Is anybody in that particular community saying, hey, maybe we ought to soften a bit?
I doubt if they are. It's done just in their private meetings with one another, and I didn't sense that there was, because it was that commitment to the right. to the old Latin rite and this very conservative approach to their practice and to their liturgy that is the attraction to the place. So there's 14 monks there, and I think 9 or 10 of them are American men in their 20s.
Wow. That's
which
fascinating.
Super interesting to me. Mm. And so I was able actually to talk more with those who were there discerning whether to join the monastery than with the monks themselves.
And how many of them were there?
Throughout the time I was there, there were 3 or 4.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And they would be there for a month at a time. So mm-hmm. we got to know each other relatively well. I was only permitted to speak with the guest master and the assistant guest master in terms of the monks themselves, with a couple of exceptions that they made because of the research project. But some of the more interesting conversations were with these young men from the United States who were discerning whether to join this monastery. And the common thread, because they were coming from all kinds of backgrounds and all kinds of countries, actually, but the common thread was, we are pursuing, we're attracted to, and we want to be a part of a community that is committed at this level to what we perceived to be the purest form of the Christian liturgy.
Which I suppose is an interesting thing to have discovered, especially given your project on stability mm-hmm. and finding the attractiveness of this particular community to folks from all over the world. Mm-hmm. Folks, Nathan Oates is my guest on this edition of Ancient Future Faith. We're talking about a sabbatical, a lengthy sabbatical he took to Italy this summer. Let's shift now to the personal level a bit. Mm-hmm. Gosh, it would probably take several episodes of Ancient Future Faith Radio to unpack what this trip meant and did for you personally, but can you take a stab at it?
I can take a stab at it, and that's really what it is. The processing is continual, but rather than to say that I learned anything, which is what people continue to ask, I don't know that I learned anything. I was certainly confronted with myself, and that was more difficult than I imagined it would be. To be dropped right into a spiritual practice and a rhythm of life that is so intense was more difficult than I expected.
Give me a couple of reasons why.
I really respect what they're doing. Mm-hmm. In fact, I crave it. But for instance, I show up and I'm shown to the guest house, which because of the earthquakes and they're having to move out of their historic monastery, the guest house is a storage container. So instantly I'm confronted on a very primal level with just basic discomfort. This is not going to be a peaceful, relaxing place to stay. It's not going to be a retreat house, which is kind of what other monasteries have felt like to me. Mm-hmm. There's no place for me to study. There's no place for me to write. I'm there to write. So instantly expectations are confronted, comfort needs are confronted. Oh, and today's a fasting day and so is tomorrow. So welcome to the monastery. And can I pray with you folks? Well, of course, you can come to all the prayer times. The first one's at 3:30 a.m.
Yeah, we get started early.
Yeah, so it was exciting. I wanted that. And yet 3 or 4 days in, I was really struggling.
I'll bet.
Because I was tired, I was hungry, I was uncomfortable. And then I was frankly mad at myself and disappointed in myself for being so bothered by all those surface human sort of fleshly things. And that really was the theme of my time there is... I struggle to put language around it, but my prayer life had eroded to kind of a spiritual task management structure.
How so?
I prayed mostly about what needed to be done and who needed to be helped.
Yes.
And so if that's the content of your prayer life, or at least the majority of it, and you're praying 7 times a day, I prayed 8 hours a day, you run out of stuff to pray real fast.
Right.
And so what becomes obvious very quickly is there's almost no adoration in my prayer life.
Oh.
There's almost no confession of sin in my prayer life.
Mm.
The Psalms are the prayer book, right? They pray through the entire 150 Psalms every week. And so you're running the full gamut of human emotion. And I block out some human emotion. I don't welcome certain feelings that are actually present, like resentment, into my relationship with Jesus, because I feel like his teachings confront those things. And yet the beauty of Scripture says, go ahead and bring this reality right into your relationship with God.
Yeah.
And that was so hard for me. And so I was just constantly being confronted by frustrating realities about my own immaturity spiritually. Another thing was, I'm a pastor. I celebrate communion. And then in that context, I'm kind of on the outside.
Right,
I never refer to myself as a Protestant pastor. It's just not my grid.
Right.
I was repeatedly referred to as the Protestant pastor. And I would like have blown that off before I went. But when I'm tired and hungry and feeling uncomfortable, it started to make me feel like an outsider.
Sure.
So they were incredibly gracious. They were so welcoming. A distinctive of Benedictine spirituality is hospitality. They welcome guests as Christ. The first meal that I joined them with, the leader, the abbot, who is the representative of Christ in their community, washes my hands. So
it's precious.
Yeah, this is to say nothing negative about their hospitality or their welcome. It's just a function of the intensity of their devotional life, just almost blowing past mine at a level that made me recognize some real needed areas of growth.
Before we turn the corner into this notion of stability, I would love for you to say a couple of things. I'm sure there were tons, but just a couple of things about the life-giving elements that you experienced there.
Well, the liturgy ended up being very life-giving, and the darn bell that rang all the time calling us to prayer, which
starting at 3:30.
Yes, I even journaled about how resentful my body was feeling towards that bell. But even in a short amount of time, just a few weeks, that changed, and it was really powerful for me. Like, the bell would ring and something in my person, in my soul, would actually begin. I can't say that it fully like celebrated, but I actually now it's the time I'm going to pray again, and I'm going to adore God because I have nothing left to ask him for. And it started to do its work in me.
Hold on. That's worth saying again. Just say that again. Folks, listen to this. Drink it in.
I think what I said is that I'm looking forward to adoring God because there's nothing left to ask him for.
Beautiful.
I think David talks about being like a child on his mother's lap, like a weaned child. And that always used to confuse me. And I think the essence of what he's celebrating there is, I don't need anything. I'm not going to draw from you. I just want to be with you.
Wow.
And candidly, if you can be candid on a radio show,
just between you and me.
Yeah, my prayer life and my devotional life needed that. And I have a lot of room to grow in just worshiping God because he's God.
Oh, me too. I suspect that's the way it is for so many of us. Folks, Nathan Oates is the fellow you're listening to. He's the pastor of Emmaus Church in Lincoln, and he's just returned from a wonderful sabbatical in Italy. And Nathan, for the last few minutes of our program, I would love for you to talk about this notion of stability. That's why you went ostensibly to go at least to look at that issue. And I remember on the last podcast, we were talking about what you might want to bring back to your church. And if there's anything that I would love for the evangelical church in North America to get, would be stability.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about your thoughts on that.
This was initially my attraction to Benedict, was that the rule begins with a description of four kinds of monks.
Right.
And one of them is
the Gyrovig.
That's right. And it so captured what I felt like was an essential problem in American culture that I just had to read more of the rule. What I can say is that monks reflected back to me both the challenge of embracing stability within our church structure, one which is relatively free of authority.
Right.
So
tell us what you mean by that.
In an evangelical context, there is so much emphasis on the autonomy of the individual and the ability to choose and your personal relationship with Jesus. And very few evangelicals would say they obey their pastors. And a lot of evangelical pastors would have a hard time saying they should obey me, right?
Right.
And yet the comments that I received back from several of the monks, they had a hard time imagining taking stability seriously outside of a very structured context where the sacraments were dependent upon the ordination of the priest,
right,
which was all happening within the structure of this historically rooted progression of spiritual authority articulated by the magisterium of the church. So they had in some cases, were willing to help me try, but really did have a challenge saying, wow, in the Protestant context, you've already removed some of the necessary components for a really stable Christian practice.
Yeah, we don't really have a lot of mechanisms in the evangelical church to bring about mutual accountability. And in some ways, it's the last thing we want, and purposefully so.
Right. And you have to just consider the context. Not only are these Roman Catholic men, they're Benedictines, and not only are they Benedictines, they're monks. So they have basically come to a point where several of them were training for the priesthood to be a parish pastor and came to the realization that, no, this is not intense enough. I need a deeper commitment. And so that just forced them into the monastic context, which is significantly structured and almost fiercely committed to stability. And the commitment to stability was seen as absolutely core to monastic life, and monastic life was core to pursuing stability.
So it was difficult then to imagine any kind of stability outside of that structure.
Yeah. So you asked, is there something we can take from this? And a couple of the structures that they did point to as having real potential for establishing deeper stability in the church and in the culture in America were marriage.
Oh.
They said this is this beautiful context in which real lived out stability can take root.
Mm.
Any kind of Christian community like a church that takes seriously the idea that we're a part of this together and takes commitment seriously in any way that we can, without getting cultish, can really emphasize the importance of commitment to one another. And then pushing back against the factors or the forces that erode stability, the primary one is consumerism. And anything that the church does to buy into a consumeristic worldview is just antithetical to this idea of contentment and strength and stability.
So we've got our work cut out for us.
Yeah, in fact, the whole project at one point almost abandoned it because I felt like, I don't know. I don't know the answer. But let me try to end with a kind of a thesis that I am working with right now. And it's this, that it is stability that moves us. And what I mean by that is that the message of the Bible, the message of Christ, is clearly go. Go into all the nations, baptize people in my name, restore all things, engage the broken, go to the dark places. So the message is go, but first, stay. Because it's only in staying that we receive the insights and begin to actually value stability and begin to practice the disciplines that enable us to do any good when we go.
Right.
So there's this huge difference between the wanderer and the missionary. And I think that difference is the missionary was sent. The wanderer is just leaving a difficult situation to get into the next one. And so there's like a foundation of truth that can only be achieved through being there, through staying for a while. And there is no shortcut to the wisdom that comes through stability. And so somehow, Chris, you and Rick and I and others who are involved in spiritual leadership have to remind people over and over and over again, including ourselves, staying, remaining, abiding, not running, not shopping, being stable is the context in which we will receive the power and the insights that will make our going not hurtful, but helpful in a broken world.
Beautifully said. Ah, goodness. Nathan, I'm hoping you'll come back and visit us again on Ancient Future Faith Radio. Will you do it?
Sure.
We need to unpack more of this because I think it's absolutely essential, as you said, as we move forward into a really unknown future. Yeah. Bless you. Thank you. Welcome home.
Thanks, Chris. Good to see you.
Good to have you back. So, folks, until we gather again for another edition of Ancient Future Faith, I want you to be thinking about this. Surely, the road to our future runs through our ancient Christian past. Until next time, the Lord be with you.
Thank you for joining us for another look at Ancient Future Faith. There is a refreshing wind of renewal blowing through the evangelical church as more and more worshipers turn for inspiration to the rich language and pattern of the ancient church, and they're rediscovering classic Christianity and learning to draw strength from a deep well of time-tested truth and tradition. Want to experience Ancient Future Faith for yourself? Join us for worship at Epiclesis in Sacramento on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. in the chapel at 4600 Winding Way. You can contact us by calling 916-572-9113 or online at epiclesis.org. That's 916-572-9113 or on the web at epiclesis.org.
Hi folks, it's Pastor Chris with one more word before we sign off. The long season after Pentecost is the perfect time to experience worship at Epiclesis, or maybe jump into a small group. There's always something happening at Epiclesis, and we'd love to have you be a part of it. Think about joining us for worship this summer. You'll be warmly welcome. As always, find more information on the web at epiclesis.org. That's epiclesis.org. The Lord be with you, and see you next Monday afternoon at 4 p.m. for another edition of Ancient Future Faith.